Broadcasting, and our first article will be from our brand new January issue, appropriately enough, here on the first Saturday of January. And so we start with our From the Letter. This is the editor's column. It's new in every issue. This is Dan Goodgame. He's the editor-in-chief, and you can reach him at roar@texasmonthly.com. And the headline of this month's column is Books Are Back. Our mission at Texas Monthly is to craft the best storytelling about this fascinating state. We gladly deliver stories to fast-growing audiences on our website and in podcasts and videos. But I'll admit that I and many of my colleagues retain a special affection for ink on paper, as we know many of you do. We're pleased that amid a decline in readership of many physical magazines, demand for print subscriptions to Texas Monthly remains strong. So, surprisingly, does demand for printed books. Some experts predicted that the rise of e-books would render the classic variety obsolete. Yet sales of both digital and physical books have risen in recent years, with the latter growing 6.4% the first 9 months of 2020. During the pandemic, we've rediscovered the pleasure of curling up with a novel after a long day spent in front of a computer. That's a trend, like online grocery shopping, that will stay with us long after COVID-19 is gone. At least, that's what I'm hoping and betting. I'm pleased to announce that in late November, Texas Monthly signed a deal to produce 4 books over the next 4 years to be published by Harper Wave, an imprint of HarperCollins. First volume will go on sale next fall and will cover in scores of articles by the state's best writers in many ways one can be Texan. The landscapes and traditions that we love, the vibrancy and diversity of our small towns and cities, our music, our cuisine, and the continuing evolution of the Lone Star State. Our second work will be a cookbook stuffed with essays and recipes from Texans of every background. It will cover barbecue and chili, tacos and tamales, kolaches and clovas. Bratwurst and beer, chicken fried steak, and King Ranch casserole, and many of the scrumptious foods brought here by the roughly 1.4 million Texans who hail from Asia and Africa. Texas Monthly readers love true crime stories, which will be the focus of our third book, with contributions from acclaimed staff writers such as Skip Hollingsworth and Katie Mine. Our heroes, like Waylands and Willies, have always been cowboys, and they'll be the subject of our fourth book, which includes chapters on classic cattle drives, vaqueros, black cowboys, rodeo stars, and contemporary cowboys. Overseeing these efforts is editor-at-large Tom Foster, with assists from several colleagues, including Kathy Blackwell, Jason Hyde, and Emily Kimbrough. These books will bring alive all the ways that Texas is changing, Tom says, along with what we're remembering and preserving. We're delighted to be working with editorial director Julie Will and her team at Harper Wave, who bring valuable experience working with the magazine staff to publish books. These books will appeal to a national audience, Julie says, addressing how Texans define home, honor, and community, celebrate the diversity of their culture, and argue over the best way to smoke a brisket. We owe thanks to our industrious literary agent, Amy Hughes, who introduced us to Julie, and to best-selling author and TM writer-at-large Sam Gwynn, who introduced us to Amy. We intend to make these books both engaging to read and physically beautiful, with original illustrations and photos in distinctive trim sizes. We hope they earn a place in your hands and on your shelves, and if you want to read them on an iPad instead, that's fine too. And one of the things that Texas Monthly does every January is put out their best and worst of 2020, and it's their cover story and feature story in this month's edition of the magazine, so we're going to hit it. We experienced a world-shaking pandemic, brain-frying election, publication of a must-be-read-to-be-disbelieved memoir for one of our state's greatest thespians, and more acts of selfishness and selflessness than we can begin to count. This was the year when Texas was tested like never before, and we passed with flying colors, and failed as colorfully as ever. So, the Bum Steer Awards, 2021. Let's face it, 2020 was no one's favorite year, from the deeply tragic, a pandemic that took too many of our lives, to the deeply comic, a pair of Arlington drivers who found a novel way to wash their cars. This was perhaps the craziest, stupidest, and bumsteriest year in Texas Monthly's history. There are bright spots, to be sure, and we'll have a section of that called The Best Things in Texas, but you had to stumble through a lot of trail dust and cow pies to find them. Now, it really is a stately pile. An Irving demolition contractor mistakenly tore down a century-old pink craftsman bungalow in Dallas's Vickery Place neighborhood that was located 2 blocks away from the roofless house that was supposed to be demolished. It's never too early for a good excuse, or even a bad one. In a pre-election interview, Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick stated that if Trump were to lose Pennsylvania, North Carolina, or Florida, it would be because the Democrats stole it. No store does more to make you nauseated. H-E-B released a line of dessert hummuses with flavors including cake batter, lemon meringue, and chocolate. Destroying actual grackles might have earned him a key to the city. Austin police arrested a man for allegedly burning down a statue of a grackle outside of Houston's City Hall. On the other hand, they did offer a very reasonable rate to film the funeral. Dallas wedding videography firm Copper Stallion Media faced a national backlash after writing a Facebook post that cruelly mocked a customer who tried to get a refund when his fiance died in a car crash months before their planned wedding date. After what Justin pulled with the media stunt to try and shake us down for a refund, we hope you sob and cry all day for what would have been your wedding day, the post said. Sorry, not sorry. If there were any justice, he'd get the gas chamber. A Wichita Falls man was arrested for assaulting his girlfriend after he farted and she complained that it smelled horrible. For the talent portion of the competition, she dug with bowling pins while hate texting with her toes. The winner of the Miss Alice Texas Beauty Pageant had her crown revoked after she was arrested for allegedly banging on the windows of an ex-boyfriend's home. She should hand that loser his limping papers. A Houston man was arrested for assault with a deadly weapon after shooting himself in the foot while allegedly threatening his girlfriend with a gun. Does this mean that nice Nigerian prince isn't going to serve as our homecoming king after all? School district officials in Manor announced that the district was built out of $2.3 million as a result of an employee owing for a phishing scam. Man, oh man, oh man, oh man. Houston appellate court judge Jerry Zimmerer, who was running for a seat on the Texas Supreme Court, said that his primary opponent, Amy Clark Meacham, was selfish for wanting to be the first woman elected chief justice. And from the makers of Grand Theft Alamo 4, hey kids, get ready for the amazing adventures of Axed Man. Fast-moving FBI agent Spunky is going to do everything he can to make it impossible for a Paxed Man to guzzle down dollars, bonk citizens on the head for trying to vote, and put LGBTQ Texans back in the closet. Watch out! At a moment's notice, Paxed Man's top aide, Flunky, will transform from a friendly subordinate into a hostile whistleblower, accusing him of accepting bribes and abusing the powers of his office. Swallowing Boston real estate investor Nate Paul will pad Paxed Man's coffers and secure a cushy job for Paxed Man's alleged former mistress, which sure won't please State Senator Angela Paxton, also known as Mrs. Paxed Man. District Court Judge Bunky is Paxed Man's worst nemesis. Paxed Man has managed to avoid his courtroom for a record-setting 5.5 years while under indictment. Can you keep history going? Uh-oh. Every time Paxed Man thinks he's shaken off relentless special prosecutor Hunky with an attempt to seek dismissal of charges, that pesky Hunky pops right back up, sometimes at double speed. Are you fascinated by the baroque scandals of Texas politics? Enthralled by video games? Frustrated that you've never been able to engage in both obsessions at the same time? Well, say hello to Paxed Man, an exciting maze case game that allows you to control the avatar of real-life Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton, also known as Paxed Man, as he avoids the long arm of the very criminal justice system that keeps him gainfully employed. Will he be charged with bribery and abuse of office and found guilty of multiple securities law violations? It's up to you to decide. So, now it's the four R's: reading, writing, arithmetic, and launch. Texas Education Agency warned educators that a URL from one of its past initiatives that had been placed on numerous school district websites was redirected to a porn site. Thankfully, nothing else went viral. Three minors in Corsicana were arrested after a video of one of them drinking from juice bottles at a local Walmart and then putting them back on the shelf went viral. Could you turn up the volume? I can't hear over those sawing sounds. Nine Gregg County jail employees resigned after it was revealed they were watching movies during their shifts, several of them on the night that an inmate successfully escaped. Fortunately, the victim was able to make a clean getaway. After an hours-long standoff, Houston police arrested a man for allegedly threatening his adult son with a gun for taking too long in the shower. So, apparently, does a sense of decency. Asked about President Trump's tweet basically claiming that a 75-year-old man who was knocked unconscious by police in upstate New York might have been an Antifa provocateur, Senator John Cornyn replied with a shrug, "You know, a lot of this stuff just goes over my head." For extra credit, which of these biology teachers is about to get fired? Klein Collins High School outside Houston gave dozens of freshmen a biology assignment that included a question about sperm and genetic markers that asked students, "Which of the suspects raped Susie?" There's at the very least the possibility. This is why she's no longer the Bayard County GOP chair. Bayard County Chair Cynthia Brame was one of a handful of county GOP leaders across the state who shared a racist social media post stating that there was, at the very least, the possibility that George Floyd's death at the hands of a Minneapolis police officer had been staged. This wasn't exactly the kind of rocky road he had in mind. A Lubbock man allegedly got drunk, had his 13-year-old stepdaughter drive him to get some ice cream, and then she nearly collided with a police car. They were hoping the first 13 times were innocent mistakes. Katy police arrested a fellow officer for allegedly stealing from a local Walmart while on duty on 14 separate occasions in a one-month period. They flunked poaching 101. The father and a son were arrested for allegedly hunting deer on the 524-acre urban campus of the University of Houston, Clear Lake. Judge to Austin voters, so sue me, and what may have been a misplaced expression of enthusiasm for female candidates, Austin voters booted well-respected District Court Judge Tim Sulak to make way for Madeline Connor, a notorious crank who was earlier blacklisted by a judge for filing frivolous lawsuits. Who was the only resident of Travis County to be declared a vexatious litigant last year. Last one ends a rotten driver. And late summer, an apparently intoxicated driver veered off a residential street in Arlington, crashed through a fence, and eventually came to a stop at the bottom of a backyard swimming pool. A week later, another Arlington driver did the exact same thing a few miles away.
Double, double, toil and trouble, fire burn and cauldron bubble, eye of Newton, shell of snail, can you help me post my bail?
A Flint woman and her daughter were charged with stalking after allegedly used witchcraft and demonic items to scare an ex-girlfriend of the daughter's husband. Dennis Bonin's been binge-listening to it ever since. On June 19th, the conservative activist group Empower Texans accidentally released expletive ridden outtakes from a podcast in which the organization's vice president, Carrie Cheshire, and general counsel, Tony McDonald, joked about Governor Greg Abbott's use of a wheelchair. This little section here is the COVID-19. The not-quite-20 Texans who spectacularly disgraced themselves during the pandemic. Number 19, it was a three-alarm blunder. Williamson County Judge Bill Gravel stopped by a county firehouse in April to borrow firefighter gear to wear to his grandson's birthday party, an act that was, as a criminal complaint pointed out, a violation of the county's shelter-in-place order, which Gravel himself had put into effect. Number 18, there's a 99.9% chance his fans won't care that he got this wrong. In July, Alan West, head of the Republican Party of Texas, said that he didn't want the state to impose draconian measures, quote, over something that has a 99.9% recovery rate. As critics noted, to extrapolate the 99.9% figure, West used an outdated statistic for the number of COVID-19 fatalities in Texas and then divided it not by the number of Texans who had contracted COVID-19, but by the state's total population, most of whom had never had the disease and therefore hadn't recovered. Number 17, well, I didn't say you had to spend all your time at home. Mayor Steve Adler announced in a November 9 Facebook video that Austin residents needed to spend more time at home in order to help contain the coronavirus, and not that this is not the time to relax, but neglected to mention that he had recorded the video at a timeshare in Cabo San Lucas, to which he had flown with seven other people on a private plane. Number 16, says the senator from a state where we proudly eat cow brains and beef cheeks and rattlesnakes, and anybody else's mouthwatering? U.S. Senator John Cornyn said that China produces pathogens like the novel coronavirus because of the culture where people eat bats and snakes and dogs and things like that. Number 15, other than the part about controlling and preventing disease, they did a great job. U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention released a woman from isolation in San Antonio's Lackland Air Force Base who then tested positive for the coronavirus. The woman who had recently returned from a trip to Wuhan, China, may have exposed at least a dozen Texans to COVID-19. 14, anybody have alien DNA on the old bingo card? One more time, alien DNA, anybody? In July, President Trump promoted a video of a speech by Houston physician Stella Emanuel in which she asserted that Americans didn't need to wear masks to protect themselves from COVID-19 because hydroxychloroquine would cure it. Asked what he thought of Emanuel's earlier claims that doctors use alien DNA for medicine and are trying to create a vaccine to keep people from becoming religious, Trump replied, "I thought her voice was an important voice." Number 13, who is that unmasked man? It's the Lone Ranter. An administrative manager at a Dallas law firm was fired after posting a Facebook rant about his local Whole Foods requiring him to wear a mask. Do I have to show the lame security guard outside of a ghetto store my CD19 results? I will show him my Glock 21 shooting range results, he wrote. They have reached the limit. I have more power than they do. They just don't know it yet. Number 12, and then he asked for a cash contribution to his COVID Be Gone emergency fund, just to be sure. In the spring, the Fort Worth-based televangelist Kenneth Copeland stated that the pandemic would be over much sooner than you think because of Christian prayer. He then summoned the wind of God to obliterate the virus, which he claimed had been destroyed forever. Number 11, you may not believe in COVID, but it believes in you. In July, San Antonio megachurch pastor John Hagee sued the city to stop a health department order that would delay the beginning of in-person classes, including at religious schools. 2 months later, after publicly minimizing the threat of the virus, the 80-year-old televangelist contracted COVID-19 and spent 15 days in the hospital with double pneumonia before recovering. Number 10, there's a 35 out of 100 chance that he's permanently damaged his reputation. Food and Drug Administration Commissioner Steve Hahn, who previously served as chief medical executive at Houston's MD Anderson Cancer Center, falsely claimed in August that an experimental blood plasma treatment would save the lives of 35 out of every 100 COVID-19 patients who receive it. In fact, the treatment would reportedly save 3 to 5% of patients. Hahn later apologized for the misstatement. New York, New York, it's a hell of a town. The Bronx is up, but compared to Texas, the COVID fatality rate's down. In May, Michael Quinn Sullivan, then head of the conservative activist group Empower Texans, stated on Facebook that a third of all coronavirus cases and deaths in the U.S. have occurred in the Democrat-run slum known as New York City and the immediate area. The state of New York has less population than Texas, but has more than 6 times as many cases of Chinese coronavirus and 19 times as many deaths. By October, Texas, likely thanks in part to those like Empower Texans who have opposed mask mandates and business shutdowns, have twice as many cases as New York State, and the number of daily fatalities is 3 to 4 times as high. Number 8, if you thought that was bad, wait till you see his Yelp review. A Cedar Park man was accused of robbing a local Asian restaurant after learning it was open for takeout service only. According to the arrest affidavit, the man, who was in the mood for a sit-down meal, screamed at the establishment's employees, shoved one of the owners, pushed items off the shelves, and stole several bottles of alcoholic beverages. Number 7, we have other reasons for wanting him to cover his mouth. After East Texas Congressman Louis Gohmert discovered that he had potentially been exposed to COVID-19 in March, he forswore a mask while leading a group of more than 100 school children on a tour of the Capitol. Gohmert, who eventually contracted the disease in July after being accused of running an office where employees were berated for wearing masks, went on to suggest that using a mask may have given him the disease. Number 6, his only regret is that he has built but one life to lose for his ignorance. In late March, Dallas media impresario and conspiracy theorist Glenn Beck stated that although at 56 he was in the danger zone during the pandemic, he wanted everyone over 50 to return to their workplaces. I would rather die than kill the country, he said. Number 5, maybe he and Glenn Beck could get a 2-for-1 deal at the mortuary. Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick said in late March that he knew plenty of seniors like himself who would be willing to die from the coronavirus to save the economy for their grandchildren. Number 4, like coffee, tea, or video evidence of your reckless behavior. During United Airlines' flight from Washington, D.C. to Austin, Texas Congressman Michael McCaul removed his face mask, a violation of the airline's rules. When McCaul's election opponent's campaign posted a video of a maskless McCaul, the congressman claimed that his mask had simply fallen off while he was asleep. The opposing campaign then posted further video of McCaul awake and scrolling through his phone while his mask hung from one of his ears. McCaul later apologized for his transgression, but not for having lied about it. Number 3, Ted's just angry because Trump didn't call Brown's wife ugly. Mid-November, Texas Senator Ted Cruz called Ohio Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown a complete ass for wearing a mask during a Senate hearing and for insisting that Senator Dan Sullivan wear a mask as well. Brown wears a mask to speak when nobody's remotely near him as an ostentatious sign of fake virtue, Cruz tweeted. At Dan Sullivan, AK, was over 50 feet away, presiding. Last I checked, 50 feet is more than 6 feet. In fact, as numerous commenters noted, Senate staffers were much closer than that to both Brown and Sullivan. The day after Cruz's tweet, 87-year-old Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley announced that he had tested positive for COVID-19. Number 2, Maybe his toothpaste was infused with something stronger. Conspiracy theorist Alex Jones, who was warned by the FDA last spring to stop hawking nano-silver-infused toothpaste as a cure for COVID-19, showed up at Austin's Barton Creek Greenbelt in August and screamed at a group of teenagers who had been hired to check hikers for reservations before allowing them onto the trail. "This is an illegal power grab of the People's Greenbelt, and it is time to free Austin," yelled a sweaty and unmasked Jones. And number one bum steer of the year plague is the spotlight shone hard and bright on Texas Governor Greg Abbott at his press conference on March 31st. The novel coronavirus was on the rise, and other states were ordering citizens to stay home and non-essential businesses to shut down. In Texas, some pressed for tight restrictions while others stoutly opposed them. Whatever course Abbott chose, many Texans would be furious, but hard times call for hard choices, right? That day, Abbott revealed a set of restrictions and guidelines that he called the Essential Services and Activities Protocols, and it wasn't immediately clear what it was. Was it a shelter-in-place order? A journalist asked. Shelter-in-place was a term of art, Abbott explained, and this wasn't one. Initial reporting held that Abbott had declined to issue a stay-at-home order, except that he had, although it was subtly disguised, as his office sought to clarify the next day. The reporters in the room couldn't quite figure out what he was saying, and many folks watching at home couldn't either. This dynamic played out again and again in 2020 as Abbott sought to deflect criticism by hiding his intentions and contradicting himself. At first, he urged local officials to take the reins and do what was necessary to fight the virus. When those measures became unpopular, he stepped in to nullify orders issued by local officials. When infections spiked once more, he placed blame on local officials for not doing enough. He took responsibility when it was politically advantageous to do so and shirked it when it wasn't. It didn't work. His attempted obfuscations kept uniting his critics from the left and the right in head-scratching confusion over the governor who didn't seem to like to govern, and his polling numbers dropped significantly over the course of the crisis, even as leaders in other states grew more popular. Abbott proclaimed that violators of his April shutdown order could be fined or even jailed. When one contentious merchant did go to jail, a rebel salon queen, Shelley Luther, valorized by conservative opponents of COVID-19 restrictions as the Rosa Parks of Dallas cosmetologists, Abbott blamed her arrest on local officials and freed her, a ruse that failed to convince hardly anybody. Perhaps the most ridiculous episode came in the wake of Abbott's decision on April 27th to prohibit local officials from requiring citizens to wear masks in public after protests against one such order in Houston. "Such moves were tyrannical," Abbott said. But then infections shot up, and local officials like Bexar County Judge Nelson Wolf begged the governor for the power to reinstate the mandate. Abbott refused, saying that his anti-mandate stance sprang from a deep conviction. "Judge Wolf and I have a philosophical difference. He believes in government mandates," the governor said in a television interview, "and I believe in individual responsibility." But at that same time, his office complained that local officials weren't using all the tools he'd made available to them. Huh? Wolf was the first to break the code by instituting a mask order that mandated not mask wearing, but instead that businesses mandate that their customers wear masks, a distinction that only a lawyer could love. Abbott, acting as if he were the host of a network game show, publicly congratulated Wolf. Earlier today, the county judge in Bexar County finally figured that out, he told a Waco TV station. "Pursuant to my plan, local governments can require stores and businesses to require masks. That's what was authorized in the plan." If only we had solved the puzzle earlier. If only Wolf had landed on the Daily Double. In a rare show of unity, Democrats and Republicans, the masked and the maskless, castigated Abbott for turning a life and death matter into a riddle. Abbott later offered his own statewide mask order, making his early coyness seem even more ridiculous. "One riddle we were never able to figure out. What does this guy think a governor is supposed to do? Every state has had a hard time with this once-in-a-century crisis, and every governor has made mistakes." In fact, earlier in the spring, Abbott posted information to his Twitter account showing a higher death toll in California and New York than in Texas, almost as if he was gloating. But by November, more Texans than Californians had died from COVID-19, even though the Golden State has 10 million more residents. There are many reasons for our state's poor response to the COVID-19 crisis, and many Texans and non-Texans who share responsibility for it. But none of them abdicated their duties as profoundly as our governor did. Which is why Greg Abbott, the Sphinx on the Colorado, is our bum steer of the plague year. Got another here, a little sidebar here. In St. Louis, during the Black Lives Matter protests earlier this year, there was a couple at a rather nice house that came out of their home and drew down on protesters marching by in the public street with a long gun, a AR-15 appearing firearm, and the wife with a handgun, waving them around and pointing them at people. And it's a photo of them side by side. And the headline, two former students whose photo you probably won't see in SMU's latest brochure, both of them graduates of Southern Methodist University, right there in Dallas. Now back to our bum steers, and best in words. She may have had a green thumb, but she was caught red-handed. In November, a woman was seen on security footage stealing a large fiddly fig plant from a Fort Worth coffee shop in broad daylight. Man, those stuffed peppers sure were addictive. Nueces County drug agents discovered nearly $1 million worth of cocaine hidden in boxes of bell peppers in the trailer of an 18-wheeler. Bill de Blasio, I'm the most despised mayor in America. Eric Johnson, hold my beer. Though he has only served for only a year as Dallas's mayor, Eric Johnson has already managed to alienate almost everyone. Case in point, in 2020, he launched a crusade to defund the bureaucracy, putting forth a proposal to cut all city salaries above $60,000. He didn't do any of the political work to build consensus among city council members, and his plan went down in a 13-to-1 vote. Weeks later, he narrowly fended off an attempt by the council to strip him of the authority to speak for the city at the legislature, a remarkable action given that Johnson served in the ledge for 10 years. You won't relish the check. Dallas restaurant Corn Dog with No Name added a $24 corn dog to its menu, complete with edible gold mustard. Let's see. Bill de Blasio, I will go down in history as the most unloved former mayor of New York City. Michael Bloomberg, oh, my 1982 Chateau Margaux. In his brief bid for the Democratic presidential nomination, former New York Mayor Mike Bloomberg quickly built a formidable campaign organization in Texas by promising staffers he'd keep them on the payroll to do the work they cared about until November, whether or not he won the primary. Almost 200 staffers signed on, believing they were in it for the long haul. Texas primary was held March 3rd. 78-year-old multi-billionaire ended his campaign on March 4th, and by March 13th, everyone employed by his Texas operation was let go. A quick reminder here to Natural Break to remind you, you're listening to Texas Monthly Magazine on Sight and Sound Broadcasting. This year marks over 50 years of enriching the lives of individuals with visual, physical, and perceptual disabilities. You can listen to Sight and Sound on one of our specially tuned radios, channel 8.5 on TV, streaming on your computer or mobile device, or listening at your convenience on our archives page. We are Sight and Sound Radio since 1967, and we return now to our text. Oh, they were dead wrong. Medicare refused to pay for the prescriptions of a 73-year-old Magnolia woman because the Social Security Administration had incorrectly listed her as deceased. Suddenly, draining the swamp took on new urgency. A vote parade in support of Donald Trump's re-election campaign that was held on Lake Travis outside Austin over Labor Day weekend didn't quite work out as planned, as choppy waters brought about by the flotilla's wakes caused stalled engines, numerous swampings, capsized boats, and at least 5 sunken watercraft. They fancied themselves all the road rage. A group of Trump supporters in cars and pickup trucks followed a Biden-Harris campaign bus up I-35 in Hayes County, surrounded the vehicle, honking and shouting, and caused at least one collision. Maybe she meant the other state senator, Royce West. When Democratic U.S. Senator nominee M.J. Hager was asked at a debate if she had tried settling her long-running feud with her former primary opponent, State Senator Royce West, she replied, Senator West is supporting me because I know that we're on the same page and we share so many of the same values. West, however, saw it differently. I'm not voting for her, he said, calling her crazy, and adding, she had a problem all along with black folks. He couldn't resist the call of the sirens. After stealing an ambulance that was parked outside Houston St. Joseph Hospital, a man led police, who found him by tracking the vehicle's GPS, on a brief car chase, and was then arrested. Here's how most Americans pronounce lapdog. Dinesh D'Souza. Defending President Trump's pronunciation of Thailand as Thailand, Houston-based author Dinesh D'Souza, who was pardoned by Trump in 2018 for election law crimes, claimed that most Americans pronounce it wrong. She'd rather put up her dukes than pick up her dookie. A Houston woman was charged with aggravated assault with a weapon after she allegedly used her car to attempt to run down a neighbor who had confronted her about her repeated failure to pick up her dog's feces. Press 1 if you want to hear your checking balance. Press 2 if hearing your checking balance made you wet yourself. Thanks to a clerical error, Legacy Texas Bank transferred $37 million into the account of a Rowlett couple, an error that was quickly corrected when the husband called and brought it to the bank's attention. It's really me, and cross my legs and hope to die. The Austin-based dating app Bumble briefly blocked actor Sharon Stone because moderators thought she was an imposter. When it came to government money, he liked to play fast and loose. A Houston man was charged with bank and wire fraud after he allegedly spent federal COVID-19 relief funds on a $233,000 Lamborghini sports car and at a strip club. Our special tonight is a sesame romesco salmon served with Aleppo pepper, garlic, pomegranate, molasses, and a quick thrust to the jugular. A man, apparently angry that he had been fired from a Dallas restaurant, was arrested after allegedly taking a sword from the staff used to cut open champagne bottles and waving it at colleagues and customers. Alexa, name a Trump campaign lawyer who's even crazier than Rudy Giuliani. At a press conference more than 2 weeks after the election, Trump campaign attorney and Dallas resident Sidney Powell alleged without evidence that what we are really dealing with here and uncovering more by the day is the massive influence of communist money through Venezuela, Cuba, and likely China and the interference with our elections here in the United States. Days later, the campaign issued a statement denying that Powell was part of its legal team. He had a dream that someday party chairs would be judged not by the content of their racist Facebook posts, but by their willingness to break their word. After posting on Facebook a Martin Luther King Jr. quote juxtaposed with a picture of a banana, Harris County GOP's chair-elect Keith Nielsen promised to renounce his position and then change his mind and then change his mind again. Here's the deal. That's a bunch of malarkey. In October, a Dallas-based beer bar offered commemorative presidential election print glasses that referred to Joe Biden as Stuttering Joe. Give me the Liberty Tree and or give me death. In late May, the Liberty Tree Tavern in Elgin finally instituted a no-mask-allowed policy. If I get it, I get it, one of the bar's customers told a reporter. It can't live forever. All right, next up we got our bum steer of the year. And it's a kind of a big one here. Let me get to it. For Petco and for worse, because it grew so overconfident about its ability to win Texas that it didn't bother to figure out how to win Texas. The state's Democratic Party is our bum steer of the year. The ancient Greeks hated hubris so much they tasked their R&D department with finding a way to put a stop to it. And what they came up with, they called drama. On stage, a fellow would say, I'm the richest and most beloved by the gods of all the men in the land. Surely tomorrow I will not be trampled by a horse. And then in Act 3, sure enough, tip-top, here come the hooves. For the better part of 30 years, Texas Democrats have dreamed of a horseless election. Since 1992, their fortunes have been in decline, and since 2002, they've been kept at arm's length from control of both the Texas House and Texas Senate, as well as from the governor's mansion and any other statewide office. The party has a long history of launching failed comeback attempts, but all of them have either failed disastrously or come up short in a way that seems designed to demolish morale and crush hopes. In 2020, the Democrats had high hopes and talked a big game, and then clip-clop, here came the hooves. There's no shame in losing when it's done well and when you learn from it, and losing well has been the goal of the party for years. In 2018, the Democrats again fell short of winning any statewide office, but gained a lot of ground with the help of an attention-grabbing Senate race between Republican Ted Cruz and Democrat Beto O'Rourke. Contest ended in a narrow loss that felt like a win to Democrats, and the results down ballot gave the party paths to expand the electoral map, perhaps even take control of the state house. Political observers across the country took notice. One of the central problems with Texas Democrats have had over the years is that few believe in them. To persuade donors to give money and candidates to run, a political party needs hype. When too much hype is generated, though, it begins to amplify itself, a feedback loop physicists call the Petco effect. The party starts to believe its own buzz and then drowns out anyone who doesn't. The consequences can be deadly. One of those consequences is mission creep, which began its pernicious spread early in 2020. At first, the party's goals were modest, with the 9 state House seats located in districts that O'Rourke had carried in 2018, but that had been won that year by Republicans. and flip the congressional districts that the moderate Republican Will Hurd was vacating, which runs from San Antonio southwest to the border and west to El Paso. But then the target list grew, fed by all that hype, by the Twitterverse's fervent belief that Trump hatred would inspire the masses to rise up and vote, and by polls that seemed to show Democrats to be in good shape. First, the list expanded to 12 state House seats, then 15, maybe 20? Sure, Hurd's seat would be nice, but wasn't it a given in a district with a Latino majority? Five more congressional districts looked like juicy opportunities, maybe even more. Eager chattering held that even Ron Wright and Van Taylor in deep red North Texas districts might fall. Though to most observers, M.J. Hager's campaign against longtime Senator John Cornyn never appeared to get off the runway, Hager's people insisted she and Cornyn were neck and neck. Privately, Democrats even maintained that they were about to win seats on the conservative state Supreme Court, perhaps knocking off Chief Justice Nathan Hecht, if not winning four outright. And then there was the seat on the Railroad Commission, and the seats on the state courts of criminal appeals. And, oh, and Joe Biden was going to win Texas, maybe by several points. Money from across the country poured in, rained down, inundated the state. Michael Bloomberg donated $2.6 million to the Democratic candidate for the Railroad Commission, a head-scratching investment. The left-wing Working Families Party, which is prominent in New York State, where it has long opposed Bloomberg, mobilized against candidates like Jeff Leach, an ex-Tea Party Republican in Collin County. It was a blitz, a bewildering barrage. Many Democrats in Texas and beyond believed all of the fanfare. One reason they were so wrong is that the polls were wrong. But another factor that was that Democrats were quivering at the opportunity to avenge past affronts. When a party gets like that, it throws caution to the wind and shuns anyone who expresses even mild skepticism towards the party's messaging or spending priorities. One typical statement offered to paleoconservative Alan West after he was elected chair of the Republican Party of Texas last summer, Texas Democratic Party spokeswoman Abby Rahman vowed, "We will beat you, your shell of an organization, and your hate-filled rhetoric up and down the ballot in November." Cue the rumbling of hooves. Republicans were genuinely worried about losing control of the state house. One thing that seemed to give them confidence was how confident the Democrats were. "They're going to underperform," one Republican strategist said about Rahman's statement. "Their peckers are just a little too hard." Were it not for that inflated sense of self-assurance, the Democrats might have had a better sense of the trouble ahead. This was the state's first election without straight ticket voting. The Democrats were counting on anti-Trump moderates in the suburbs to follow them all the way down the ballot. And because of the pandemic, Democratic candidates weren't doing much door knocking, even though it could have been done safely with masks and distancing. As such, many Texans were much likelier to have laid eyes on Republican candidates who had shown no such reticence. Meanwhile, though the Democrats' war chests were sloshing with cash, not everyone saw a piece of it. The money saturated supposedly swing districts in a few parts of the state, while much of Texas, including the Rio Grande Valley, a crucial part of the Texas Democratic coalition, got little attention. Biden's campaign, the largest statewide effort, never took the state seriously enough to invest. In November, Democrats didn't lose ground in the aggregate, but they gained very little. They won a straight state Senate seat, but made no headway in the state house or in Congress. All of the money and the hype and the time appeared to have been for nothing. And the Democrats' failure to take the state house means the Republicans will have total control of redistricting in 2021, and with it, the ability to frame the state's politics until the next round of redistricting in 2031. Better luck next decade, suckers! Worse still, after pushing the hype machine too hard this year, Democrats will have a difficult time turning it back the next time they need it. It will probably be a while before Bloomberg and the Working Families Party team up here again, and an equally long while before this magazine once again runs an election season cover line like "Why Texas Democrats Will Have Plenty to Celebrate." Perhaps most importantly, the election results dispelled several core myths the party held dear. The first was that, as O'Rourke said so often, Texas wasn't a red state, but a non-voting state. The theory had been that as soon as turnout jumped high enough, Texas would start glowing a bright shade of purple. And in 2020, the state had record turnout, and the result still wasn't that good for the party. A lot of new Democrats voted, but so did a lot of new Republicans, some of them perhaps spooked by O'Rourke's near win in 2018 and by the Democratic Party's resurgent left wing with its reckless talk of abolishing police departments and the oil and gas industry and private health insurance. Or maybe some of them just had a newfound love of President Trump. More perplexing is who voted and how. In those suburban House districts, plenty of moderate Texans voted for Biden at the top and Republican candidates down ballot, signaling that Trump turned them off, but the Dems failed to win them over. In addition to making only limited gains in the suburbs, The party saw its support among Latino voters modestly recede, especially in the Valley, where a sharp uptick in support for Trump seems to have taken Democrats by surprise, a sign that something went very, very wrong at Party HQ. In other words, the Democrats lost ground with what they thought were their core constituencies while failing to make inroads with swing voters. That's no recipe for success, and it challenged some of the party's assumptions about how it was going to take the state. A wave of recriminations followed, and it became clear that the party had had no real plan for South Texas, not much of a plan for the rest of the state. Who needs a plan when your destiny awaits you? When high turnout, anti-Trump sentiment, and changing demographics will carry you to victory as if on the wings of angels. Democrats lost 8 of the 9 state House seats they'd started out gunning for, many by substantial margins, and the one they did win was offset by a loss elsewhere. They won no seats in Congress, including Will Hurd's old district, which they thought was a lock. Even this didn't stop the bluster. In an otherwise contrite statement made the day after the election, party chief chair Gilberto Hinojosa, who rose to lead the party from Cameron County, one of the border counties that swung right, roared, "Any pundit who claimed Democrats lost Texas can't see the forest for the trees." The party would resume the fight in 2022. Clip, clop, clip, clop. For expressing the kind of blind confidence in the face of reality that most of us can only dream of, the Texas Democratic Party is, God love them, our bum steer of the year. Now, returning to the section, the best things in Texas. The ancient Romans had a phrase for years like this, Annus Horribilis, which really requires no translation. If you need a reminder of why 2020 qualifies as one, flip back to page 66. Check out our annual Bum Steer Awards Roundup. Looking for a reminder of what makes Texas great, even during the worst of times, you come to the right place. Dancing families, cute animals, the best Samaritans, devoted public officials, we had them all. Maybe not enough for 2020 to qualify us as an Annus Mirabilis, but just enough if you squint to make it look like an Animus Tolerabilis. One of the Houston Zoo's pair of clouded leopards, which are endangered in their native Asia, gave birth to 2 cubs that only mildly resembled a cross between a ferret and the extraterrestrial creatures from a Ridley Scott movie. UT Birmingham Basin football player John O'Kelly recovered a fumble by A&M Kingville's quarterback, ran 65 yards toward the end zone, and then mid-stride on the 20-yard line, handed the ball over his teammate Chris Hode, who scored the touchdown on his last day as a college football player. After a dog fled a car accident, more than a dozen Good Samaritans got out of the vehicles and ran along Houston's Beltway 8 to catch the animal and return him to his owners. Journalist Jessica Huseman, after deciding to return to her home state from New York City, summed up the feelings of millions of misunderstood Texans when she told her tens of thousands of Twitter followers, "When I say on this site that I'm moving to Texas, it's frequently met with contempt. If you think a state that could contain 40 Connecticuts is among the most racially and culturally diverse in the nation and is geographically wildly diverse is all one thing, and you're stupid." James Beard Award-winning Houston chef Chris Shepard turned his non-profit Southern Smoke Organization into a national leader in pandemic relief, raising more than $4 million and counting for hard-strapped restaurant industry workers across the country. The Dixie Chicks cast off the antebellum connotations of their name and, newly christened as the Chicks, released their first studio album in 14 years, the acclaimed Gaslighter. Author John R. Erickson of Perryton published The Case of the Red Rubber Ball, the 75th installment in his popular Hank the Cowdog series. A Texas family staged a goofy and joyous dance routine in their kitchen to the tune of Jess Glynn's Hold My Hand that has drawn millions of viewers. After the Fredericksburg High School class of 2020 realized that the pandemic had put the kibosh on its senior trip to Six Flags Fiesta, Texas, the seniors donated to a local food bank the $10,850 they had spent 4 years raising. Dia Lathora, a 20-year-old Dallas gamer, was playing Fortnite remotely with 17-year-old Aiden Jackson, who lives in Widnes, England, when Jackson suffered an epileptic seizure. Lathora quickly got in touch with British police and an ambulance was dispatched to Jackson's home, where he received the necessary medical treatment. His parents, who were at home, were unaware that anything was wrong with their son until the medics arrived. On March 30th, Houston-raised hitmaker Lizzo bought lunch for pandemic-burdened hospital workers around the country. "I love you guys. Thank you so much for being the heroes in this story," the singer said. Eric Hale, who was raised amid abuse and poverty, became the first black man to be named the Texas Teacher of the Year for his work at Dallas's David G. Burnett Elementary School, where 98% of the students live below the poverty line. And then, thinking outside the ballot boxes is your tax dollars at work. In Harris County, Lena Hidalgo and Chris Holland fought off legal challenges to hold a successful election in the middle of a pandemic. For years, politicos and policy wonks have kicked around ideas for how to increase election turnout in Texas, where voters usually show up at pitiful low numbers. And Texas officials knew that if turnout did rise during 2020's closely contested presidential election, the pandemic would pose tremendous challenges to our electoral infrastructure. Enter 29-year-old Harris County Judge Lena Hidalgo and 34-year-old County Clerk Chris Hollins. Under Hidalgo's leadership, Harris County Commissioner's Court approved $29 million for the election, seven times more than in 2016. But just as important as the funding was choosing the right election administrator. When the sitting county clerk resigned in May following a disastrous March primary election marred by six-hour lines and computer glitches, the commissioner selected Hollins, a management consultant at McKinsey & Company and the Texas Democratic Party's vice chair of finance, to serve as interim clerk. It was an unconventional pick. Hollins, a fifth-generation Texan, had never held public office or overseen an election, but he hit the ground running. Embracing an array of innovative ideas, including 24-hour voting, drive-through voting, and ballot drop boxes, Hollins recruited 11,000 poll workers to staff a record number of early voting locations as well as Election Day polling places, and he spent heavily on personal protective equipment for both election workers and voters. It's important that voters are able to cast their votes safely, Hollins told Texas Monthly before the election, but also to do so conveniently and with peace of mind, knowing that their votes are going to be counted. Not all of Hollins' ideas were universally embraced. Knowing that some people wouldn't feel safe voting in person during a pandemic, he originally planned to mail absentee ballots to every one of Harris County's 2.4 million registered voters. That move didn't sit well with state Republicans, who repeated Donald Trump's unfounded claims that the unsolicited ballots would lead to election fraud. Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton sued Hollins to stop the plan. In the end, Hollins mailed ballots only to residents 65 and older. Paxton's lawsuit was just the opening salvo in state Republicans' legal battle against Hollins. In October, Governor Greg Abbott ordered that counties have only one site for drop-off ballots, a move that disproportionately affected urban counties that tend to vote for Democrats. Hollins, who had intended to maintain a dozen drop-off sites within a 1,700-square-mile county, accused Abbott of engaging in prejudicial and dangerous actions, but the decision stood. Then, a week before Election Day, a group of Harris County Republicans sued Hollins over drive-thru voting, claiming the practice was illegal under Texas election law. Hollins prevailed in court, but the lawsuit raised the frightening prospect that the 127,000 people who had already cast ballots at drive-thru polling places would have their votes invalidated. Despite all of this resistance, Hidalgo and Hollins' efforts to encourage voter participation paid off. 68% of the county's registered voters cast a ballot in the November election, the highest turnout there since 1992, and nearly 10 percentage points higher than in 2016. That eclipsed the turnout in the next two most populous counties, Dallas at 66% and Bayer at 65%, as well as the state's overall 66% turnout. Hollins has returned to the private sector, while Hidalgo has turned her attention to containing the spread of COVID-19. But their successful administration of the 2020 election, under difficult circumstances, may become a model for election officials statewide. Harris County's experience suggests that when Texans are provided a safe, convenient opportunity to vote, they take it. And next up, we got back in the state section. We got Meanwhile in Texas, since we're all on the subject here. 6 years after her chihuahua went missing, a San Antonio woman received a voicemail from an animal shelter in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, explaining that someone had found her pet. A Richmond Homeowners Association requested a woman take down the Halloween decorations in her front yard, which featured skeletons pole dancing in colorful wigs. A dog in Plano got its paw stuck in the trigger of a pistol tucked in its owner's waistband and fired a shot into the man's eye. Police found stacks of stolen tools with an estimated value of more than $1 million in a Katie man's home after arresting him on drug charges. A Wichita Falls man allegedly stole a car from a stranger at a bar, brought it back a few hours later, and when arrested, told police he drove away with the vehicle as a joke. A raccoon loose in the halls of Euless Trinity High School dodged staff members and an animal control officer before evading capture when a pursuer opened a door to set it free. On a flight from Jacksonville, Florida to Houston, an intoxicated Universal City woman allegedly threw up on herself, took off her pants, got into an altercation with another passenger, and attempted to hit a flight attendant, ultimately forcing the plane to land in Mobile, Alabama. Arlington residents made multiple 911 calls about a spiky, gorilla-sized creature with five legs roaming the streets, which police later identified as a man on stilts dressed up for Halloween as the psychological image of fear. And one more short item here. This is from State. This is Style and Design. It's made in Texas. It's by Ariel Avila. It's about soul cycles. The maker is Neo Tomei of Tomei Cycles. Location is in Austin. And though bikes are commonly used for commuting in Neo Tomei's hometown of Niigata, Japan, it wasn't until after the artist moved to Boston for college and later connected with the cycling community there that he was struck by how similar bike frames are to sculptures. While working for a sculpting company that produced everything from bronze statues to fiberglass dinosaurs, Tomei, now 42, started experimenting with making bikes. He founded Tomei Cycles in 2012 and, tired of the cold, moved to Austin 2 years later. His workshop offers a custom option as well as two stock models, all of which are handcrafted with high-end steel tubing. Process is spiritual, Tomei says, adding, to build bikes, I have to be happy. Even though we got a little bit of time left here, we've kind of run out of stuff we can fit into the time we have remaining. And so that brings us to the end of our reading, unfortunately, for today. You've been listening to Texas Monthly Magazine, Saturdays at 5 and Mondays at 2 in the afternoons on Sight into Sound Broadcasting, your print information source.
Next, on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Travelin' Texas, followed by Texas Gardener at 4:30.
This is a Recording Library of West Texas Community Update.
The Take Care of Texas Kids Art Contest runs from January 4th through March 5th, 2021. K-5 students in Texas are invited to enter their artwork. Six students and one lucky teacher will win a tablet or laptop. To sign up or for more details, visit takecareoftexas.org/kids/k-5-art-contest.
We begin our first book of the new year with What Unites Us by Dan Rather, now airing on the Noon Book Hour. The former CBS anchor says, I find myself thinking deeply about what it means to love America, as I surely do. At a moment of crisis over our national identity, Rather is reflecting on what it means to be an American. Now, with this collection of original essays, he reminds us of the principles upon which the United States was founded, looking at the freedoms that define us, from the vote to the press, the values that have transformed us, from empathy to inclusion to service, the institutions that sustain us, such as public education, and the traits that helped form our young country, such as taking on daunting challenges in medicine and science. As a living witness to historical change, he offers up an intimate view of history, tracing where we have been in order to help us chart a way forward and heal our bitter divisions. With a fundamental sense of hope, What Unites Us is the book to inspire conversation and listening, and to remind us all how we are finally one. What Unites Us by Dan Rather, weekdays at noon and 2 a.m. on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Thank you. Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 32 and mostly cloudy. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a low in the mid-20s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the upper 30s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the low 30s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 4 p.m.
Hello and welcome to our program. My name is Lynette McLamory, and I'll be reading Travelin' Texas here on Sight and the Sound Radio. For today's program, I'll be reading articles from the Texas Highways website, and our first one is titled, For Your Amusement, How Serving Ice Cream at Astroworld Became a Lesson in Magical Thinking, by Marcus J. Guillory. I lied about my age on the job application. I even doctored a Xerox copy of my birth certificate with zero regard for any possible fines or imprisonment. I had to get this job, but I was 15, too young. The minimum age to work at Astroworld was 16. Who could blame me, though? A job at Astroworld was the hottest thing a teenager could do in Houston in the 80s. I sat in the personnel reception area, waiting for my name to be called. My mother waited in her car in the parking lot listening to Luther Vandross, who windows down and managing the humidity and heat with a hand fan depicting Jesus washing his disciples' feet. It didn't take long. I got the job. A week later, I put on the blue and yellow uniform with the name tag. I had arrived. I was officially part of the dream. Astroworld was an amusement park owned by Six Flags of America, located between Kirby and Fannin Drives, south of the 610 Loop. It was built to complement the famed Astrodome, affectionately known as the Eighth Wonder of the World, and opened in 1968 as part of the Astrodomane envisioned by former Houston Mayor Roy Huffhines. The park sat in the middle of urban sprawl, unlike most amusement parks across the country that were sequestered in small neighboring towns and suburbs of larger cities. Thus, access to Astroworld was very democratic. On any given day, you could take the Metro bus from any part of the city and get delivered right to the doorstep of this magical land. A paved overpass crossed the bustling 610 Loop from the Astrodome parking area, leading to a fanciful gated entrance. Behind the gate, various rides made of wood and steel painted in bright colors of metallic shades jolted in the air, twisting and turning. Their names only elevated their majesty. The Texas Cyclone, the largest roller coaster at Astroworld, with its intricate matrix of white wood supporting brick-red steel tracks. Or Greased Lightning, which was one large blue steel circle that sent riders in dizzying loops both backward and forward. Or Excalibur, the coral-colored mine train coaster that anchored the park on the opposite side of the Texas Cyclone. You could see all of this from the loop. It wasn't far. As a middle schooler, I rode the school bus, yellow school bus, from the rough-and-tumble neighborhood of South Park to T.H. Rogers Middle School in the glitzy Tanglewood area near River Oaks. Along the way, I navigated my expectations of a better life with the odd dichotomy of the haves and have-nots on display Monday through Friday. But when our school bus passed by Astroworld, I often stared at the spectacular rides tucked behind the gate. Somehow, that brief glimpse reaffirmed an idea that anything was possible. Any desire could be fulfilled, any want met, any reality changed. This was the promise of Astroworld. Thrill and jubilation if you pull over, park your car by the Astrodome, and walk over the loop. Beyond the entrance were various themed areas with particular designs, costumes, and rides. There was the Alpine Valley, with its Swiss chocolate kiosks and sleigh ride roller coaster. European Village, with the Astro Needle and French taxis. Nottingham Village, a truncated Renaissance fair with smoked turkey legs. The Excalibur roller coaster, and plenty more. One might say it was a larger version of Disneyland's It's a Small World. But Disneyland it was not, nor was it Six Flags in Arlington. Astroworld was ours, It belonged to the children of Houston, not the world, or even Texas at large, although we were willing to share. Astroworld was a distinctly Houston destination. As a child, I remember the sights, sounds, and smells at Astroworld constantly changing with each new turn in the park. One minute you'd smell caramel candy, the next strawberry slushies, while walking from a medieval village to an old west town. Mandolins turned to banjos. Turkey legs turned to beef jerky. More sugar, more rides. It was nonstop. Once, when I was 3 years old, my older sister held me as we waited in line for the prop plane carousel. My first sugar rush of the day was on the decline, but cotton candy wasn't far. I could smell it. I watched the miniature planes go up and down with kids in the cockpit. "Who's going to fly the plane?" I wondered nervously. I looked at the Astroworld worker manning the ride, but he wasn't flying the planes. I got scared. I didn't know how to fly a plane, and I sure as hell didn't believe my sister knew either. But as my turn came and my sister had to drag me into the plane because I was crying and didn't want to crash, the Astroworld worker strolled over and told me I wouldn't have to fly the plane by myself. He would help me. He promised. I believed him. And he was right. I could fly that plane. I just had to believe. In addition to manning the games and rides, Astroworld workers were constantly hawking some candy or treat for a few bucks. Kids were caught between distractions while standing in long lines. Sensory overload. If you were with your parents, then you heard the constant rattle of instructions from them. Wait there. Don't touch that. And the inevitable, stop right there. This was before timeouts and attempts to reason with a six-year-old. A kid or two were bound to get a quick spanking, followed by cries and screams, but it never lasted long. There was always something to redirect a child, whether a new ride or a costumed character prancing about to keep the energy up. But this was also a place where young children were discovering courage. The huge roller coasters and spinning Ferris wheels presented a challenge, a moment to let go of their parents' hands and take a belted seat in an iron monstrosity. Many wouldn't accept the dare, deciding to stand on the sidelines in their guardian's safety nets. Others would muster up the courage, fear on their faces, until the buzzer sounded and the ride took off. Hands in the air, screaming at the top of their lungs, kids discovered the fear was in their minds and all they had to do was let go. What started out as something to be avoided turned into something to be desired. Ask anyone who's addicted to roller coasters and they will tell you, "I thought I was going to die, but then it was fun." A rite of passage? Maybe. But sensory stimulation helps you overcome fear and many times delivers joy. Between sugary treats and long lines, I was conquering my fear of roller coasters and human-sized cartoon characters. Farewell to childhood. As a teenager, the nature and reason for going to Astroworld changed. Your parents dropped you and your friends off. You brought a Coke can for a discounted ticket, or you held the highly coveted season pass. You met friends and you made new friends, particularly of the opposite sex. For teenagers in the 80s, Astroworld was like the mall, a place to see and be seen. There were teenagers from all over the city, and this huge melting pot was perfect for romance. Astroworld had a few arcades that set the stage for flirting and making small talk. "What school you go to?" "He thinks you're cute." "Her boyfriend is here." And what was more important than reaching the high score on Galaxian? A clean napkin with a phone number and a heart. Perhaps even more exciting than the arcade, Video City near Alpine Village offered a teen nightclub experience complete with a local radio DJ and a TV dance show called Video City Live. This was in an era when boys and girls danced with each other, which meant a teenage boy had to muster enough courage to ask, "You want to dance with me?" Or, if you were lucky, a girl's friend would walk over to you and say, "My friend want to dance with you." If you were really lucky, you'd find a quiet dark area in the park to kiss. It was almost an unwritten rule that at a certain age, you stayed at Astroworld well into the evening, as younger kids would leave, having exhausted themselves and their parents. During these evening hours, Astroworld offered specialty themes like Fright Night around Halloween and Holiday in the Park during Christmas time with manufactured snow. Near the rear of the park was the Southern Star Amphitheater, which hosted concerts from groups like Run-DMC and AC/DC. At 15 years old, my friends and I were convinced that working at Astroworld was beyond cool. Access to rides, games, and girls for a wage? You couldn't beat that. Every Astroworld moment in my life, up to that point, had been filled with excitement, intrigue, and joy. Surely those feelings would exponentially